if I could go back now and tell that young person, tell me, and say, look, it's okay to ask for help. It's okay that you need help in things. Then maybe, if I'd have listened to myself, I may have not then as it not led to an eating disorder like it did.
Hey everyone, it's Natalie here and welcome back to my podcast. How are you all doing? Can you believe we're nearly at the end of October? Say what? And before we know it, the year 2021 will be over. Anyways, I hope you're all keeping well, regardless of where you may be in the world right now. I know it's been a while since I last updated this space, so it feels really great to be back with a new episode for you all today. This is an episode that I recorded with Dr. Steven Lineker sometime in the summer this year, so I'm so excited to be able to share this with you all today. I also want to take this moment to say a big thank you to each and every one of you for your support and for listening to my podcast. Whenever I look at the demographics of my listeners, I'm just mind blown that people from different parts of the world are discovering my little baby. So thank you. Now, I'd like to introduce you to my guest for this episode, and he is Dr. Steven Lineker, or as he likes to be known, Steve. Steve is a clinical psychologist that works at a specialist eating disorder service for children and adolescents in Derbyshire. He is passionate about supporting the well-being of carers of people with eating disorders, and he strongly believes that recovery from an eating disorder is possible. And he says this not only as a clinician, but as someone who has experienced his own eating disorder and is fully recovered today. Steve has worked closely with the national eating disorder charity called BEAT here in England, and he is also the chair of the trustees board for a local eating disorders charity called Freed Beaches. You guys, I cannot wait for you to hear from Steve because he will be sharing his recovery journey from an eating disorder with us in this episode. And he will also be talking about how he had to manage and continues to cope with type 1 diabetes, a lifelong health condition which developed during his recovery from an eating disorder, alongside his experience of navigating and learning to accept his experience of cerebral palsy, a physical disability that he was born with. Steve is a true inspiration, and his recovery story is filled with so much resilience, hope, and light. Now, that's all from me for now. And as always, may this episode nourish you and bring you the healing that you need. Okay, Steve, so welcome and thank you so much for coming on to my podcast.
Hi, Natalie. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, of course. So, Steve, you know, first of all, I just want to say thank you for joining me again, because the first time we recorded this episode, somehow the record button did not hit. I don't know what happened. So thank you for coming on again and for your willingness to share your story with us. I believe that, you know, the people who will be tuning into this episode We really feel moved and inspired by what you will be sharing with us today.
Well, that's what I'm hoping. Obviously, what I want to be able to explain is is my journey really to recovery, but also how now I can use it in my clinical practice as a clinical psychologist. And I find it very useful, understanding the patients and the clients that I see by having that other side knowledge. And obviously anybody can experience mental health problems, and it's important to get it out there that it can happen to anyone, and you know, sort of anyone can recover from it.
Yeah, that's so true, and a great message to really spread. Yeah. So before we dive into your journey and all of that, could you tell us a little bit more about who you are today? Yes.
So I'm a clinical psychologist that works with the Derbyshire CAMHS Eating Disorder Service. So I work with young people now, but I did used to work with adults with eating disorders. And prior to that, I've also had experience of working with people with more generic mental health problems. Mm-hmm. So I'm now 42 years old. I've been qualified since 2011. So nearly 11 years, and it's something that I've had to manage during both training and qualified as managing my own mental health, but it's something that I do manage well, and I also know the things that may push me over the edge or things that I need to do to help myself. So that's a bit about me. I'm also somebody that works as a trustee on a charity board. It's called Freed Beaches Eating Disorder Service, which is a local eating disorder service in Nottinghamshire. So I act as the chair of the trustee board there.
Cool, very cool. 11 years as a clinical psychologist, that is a long time.
Yeah, it is. It's obviously had its challenges, and it's obviously had, but it's a very rewarding job.
Yes.
I think there is often systems and things that get me frustrated, but, sort of seeing people get better or at least move towards recovery, because I don't think anybody that goes through therapy, once they've finished, they're totally better. You've got mm-hmm. sort of a lot of learning and reflection and to use the skills that you've learned mm-hmm. after therapy. So, but it's nice to be able to help people to move on to that journey.
Yeah, being a part of that longer life journey. Yeah. Okay, so before we jump into your journey, Steve, tell us one fun fact about you. One fun fact that will help our listeners feel a bit closer to you as well.
My fun facts. Well, I mean, obviously at the moment, I'm really interested in football. And obviously at the moment, we've just got the Euros, haven't we?
Yes.
I also support my local team, I'm an avid fan and a season ticket holder, and I also sort of enjoy a lot of films. I watch a lot of films. I've got one of those cinema passes that we go to, and it's been quite difficult during the COVID, obviously, not with all the cinemas being shut, but I'm looking forward to hopefully reconnecting with people and doing more social activities. But I'm also somebody that enjoys traveling, and as you know, I've just been away to Gran Canaria and are currently on my quarantining. but hopefully the next time I go, we won't have to do that. We're being double vaccinated and things like that. So but yeah, they're some of the things that I really enjoy doing. And I think your values when you're actually speaking with people as well is important to help people to recover from mental health. You know, sort of being able to do the things. And I know that's what's helped me when I was ill, to be able to do things that are in your heart.
Yeah.
And I know COVID, for example, has stopped a lot of people from being able to do the things that are in their heart. It's something that I think is really important to consider when you're working with people, as to what makes them tick and what makes them have fun and enjoy things. Obviously, I enjoy connecting with my friends. And that was really tough during the times while it's been on lockdown.
Yeah.
But again, that's something that's starting to reemerge. And I also enjoy going to the racing. So I often go to the local race course to watch horse race. Not big on betting, but you have a little go with it when you go and watch them. I do enjoy the day out.
Yeah, I think having fun is such an important part of life, and reconnecting with your values is a big part. It's a big part of recovery. So yeah, thank you for sharing all these fun facts about you. A big win for England last night when they got into the finals for the Euros. I'll be watching that match for sure on Sunday, I believe.
And I mean, obviously, I remember that it is only a game, but I do think it does lift the country. When your national team wins things, even if people aren't an avid supporter of football, I think it's just that feel-good factor, which we all need. It doesn't matter really what sport it is. But when there's a lot of media and some good things happen, it does seem to lift the country a little bit.
Yeah, it definitely does. Well, now to change the subject to a darker time in your life. Yeah, so if you wouldn't mind, Steve, perhaps you can tell us about when you first realized or first noticed that your relationship with your body and your relationship with food started to become a little bit more intense or confusing or complicated.
I mean, it was during my teenage years, really, early teenage years, that I started to be much more focused on my body. I had mild cerebral palsy, so I experienced quite a lot of bullying as a child due to my limp, and I had several operations on it. So that made me very focused on my body. And also, as I was growing older, I started to gain a little bit of weight. I was never excessively overweight, but when there are differences, unfortunately, children can pick them out. And, it caused quite a lot of problems with being bullied and affecting my self-esteem as I was growing up. And what then started to sort of develop was then I started to focus on what I was eating. And at the time, and again, I think this is nobody's fault, but at the time, and remember, we are talking, 30 years ago. At the time, it was encouraged to try and lose a bit of weight. I started to get really focused on what I was eating. My mum and dad had a takeaway shop, so, you know, there was obviously a lot of cultural and family culture around food, and it was there in abundance. And I do enjoy food. It's something that I sort of like to have, but I think emotionally I started to use it as a comfort thing. So the decision was made after sort of liaising with mum and dad that, you know, I would try to reduce my intake, which again, I don't advocate any parents suggesting to anybody that's below 18 to do, you know, and without medical support.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, that was something, and it was amazing that I got into structured pattern of eating, and it did start to have what I thought was a positive effect. I started to lose a bit of weight. It also influenced how people responded to me at school. I started to get praise from it, you know, so there was a lot of positives in doing it. And then it was something that then became habitual. And over time, I lost weight. And when I got to a point where, you know, I was quite, you know, very underweight, really, it was at a point where I couldn't stop. It was a point where I felt as though the thoughts about food were very intense. If I ate something that I considered a bad food, then it was decided that I'd get a lot of guilty feelings around it. And obviously we advocate now that there are no bad foods.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you eat a lot of salads, that's not very good. Mm-hmm. And if you eat a lot of chocolate, that's not very good. But
that's right.
A well-balanced sort of diet and intake is what's mm-hmm. required, and there should be no sort of values placed on food. And unfortunately, the media at the time, and still today to a certain extent, emphasizes this is a good food, this is a bad food, and I don't think that's very helpful.
Yeah.
So I got to about 16, and it was there, obviously around GCSE times, and that you know, I was really struggling with my thoughts around eating. I found it very difficult to do my GCSEs. I did do them and did reasonably well, but at the same time, again, that I didn't do as well as I thought I should.
Right.
And I think, you know, again, that ate into my self-esteem again. I'm not good enough.
Yeah.
And what we do know is that a lot of young people have that view, that have eating disorders and probably other mental health conditions as well, is that core belief of I'm not good enough. And obviously what they're searching for, like I was searching for, is something to help me to feel better.
Right. So this is such a big theme, right? It's that the whatever it is that's happening with food, the control that you get from eating good foods or the amount of exercising that you're doing, it's a coping mechanism, isn't it, to help one to feel like, oh, yeah, I'm good at something.
Yeah, definitely. And that's, you know, it's feeling as though you've got some sort of control as well over things that you may feel not have, you know, compared to other things that you feel as though you may not have any control over.
Such as?
So I suppose that, you know, again, I didn't feel as though I felt overwhelmed with the GCSEs, the studying. I felt overwhelmed in the fact that I felt as though I wasn't accepted as much as other people. I compared myself to my body to other people and thought it's not good enough. I needed to do better.
Yeah.
So all those sort of thoughts, whereas actually being able to lose some weight, get some praise for it, was a positive, because not a lot of other people, there was other young people that were also overweight and say, admiring how I could do it. And, you know, and it did give me that social connection for a short time. So, yeah, I mean, I became then obsessed with obviously getting on the scales, having that sort of boost that you get when you see the scales go down. And if it did go up, you started to feel as though you're not, again, that thought came back into your head, you're not doing it well enough, or you've got to try harder.
Yeah.
Those sort of thoughts come into your mind. And I think what happened was, you know, it was over a couple of years. It wasn't a massive drop down in weight immediately, but it did get to a point where physically I was very unwell. And I was going to the gym sometimes four times a day for an hour, and it became obsessive. In the end, the gym did cancel my membership and stop me going, but it took them a long time to do that.
Hang on a second. You're saying you went to the gym 3 to 4 times in a day?
Yeah.
Wow. For
towards just prior to going to hospital, they did stop that, but it took them a long time, and I think I was extremely low weight before they said, you're not well enough to go in.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how gyms work now, because I've never really gone back into it.
Yeah.
Because I feel as though it's something that triggers me.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Trying to work harder, you're seeing the numbers on the machines. Mm-hmm. But I think at the time there was very little monitoring of who comes in and goes out of gyms. If you're paying your annual or your monthly fee, then they were happy. But I was getting to a point where I was feeling dizzy. It never resulted in getting the ambulance, but it was a point where I was trying to improve my body, or think I wasn't trying to improve my body, when actually I was just making it more and more unhealthy.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you can see it now looking back, right? But at the time when you were deep in the pain and the suffering and the behavior itself, did you recognize that something's not right here, that I don't feel free here, or were you not really able to recognize that?
I mean, prior to going into hospital, because I only went into hospital just before my 18th birthday, but prior to that, I recognized something's not right. But for a long time, I didn't. I just thought, this is what I need to be doing. I've got to do this to make myself better. For a long time, I had no awareness of it. And unfortunately, that's what we see in a lot of young people that are stuck in an eating disorder. Initially, they're in what we call pre-contemplation stage, or what lay people might call they're in denial. And I think a lot of the time I was in that. But as it started to get worse and worse, I realised that what I was doing is not going to help me. But for a long time, I thought it was.
So what was the turning point?
Obviously, I'd been to the GP several times. The GP had dismissed my mum's concerns several times. I mean, again, 25 to 30 years ago, I didn't fit the anorexia label. Because it had amenorrhea in, and it was very much in the diagnostic categories, very much a female disorder. But they didn't, the GP obviously didn't have, you know, sort of the experience of eating disorders in males, or to understand it. Mm-hmm. And I think we went 3 or 4 times before we were referred to a mental health service. And I think that was helpful initially, because there was an awareness that actually, yes, there is something wrong. And I think although I knew there was things wrong, because I was still very unhappy and low in mood and very anxious. Yes, for a short time doing the exercise or skipping a meal was a boost to that, but it was very short-lived.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I got very much, you know, a lot of physical health problems through experiencing an eating disorder. You know, I was feeling dizzy. I was cold all the time. In the end, it resulted me in getting type 1 diabetes, but that was when I was in the first hospital. Okay. And for a long time, they didn't realise that had developed type 1 diabetes. They continued to think that I was doing compensatory behaviours.
Yeah.
So, I, you know, I had to spend a bit of time on a medical ward, which was also very difficult because I was trying to have to come to terms with a long-term health condition that required insulin therapy and blood monitoring and a whole change to how you have to think about food, because even today I have to still think about food and what's in it, which made the recovery from an eating disorder even more difficult.
I bet. You know, Steve, for those people who are listening who may not really know how having type 1 diabetes complicates recovery, right? Would you mind sharing your lived experience of the two? Yeah.
So yeah, having type 1 diabetes, you know, obviously requires you to have a good understanding of the carbohydrates that you eat, because you've got to inject insulin that matches that. And therefore, when I got obsessed before getting diabetes, looking at packets, looking at fat content, looking at calorie content, that was part of the eating disorder. But when they then were saying, okay, well, actually, you need to know about what the carbs are of foods so you can match your insulin dose to that, that then still required me to look at packets, which then sort of was a maintaining factor for eating disorder thoughts, because looking at packets and comparing, right, is this more or is this less, which one can I eat, you know, obviously caused a lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
So trying to move away from and realising what was eating disorder cognitions and what is what I need to do for my diabetes care became very complicated.
Yeah, so how are you... I mean, how did you navigate that, and how are you managing this in your day-to-day right now?
I suppose the way I looked at it, I mean, obviously I had, after the first inpatient stay, which was on a generic psychiatric ward, which is where I then had to go to a medical ward and get diagnosed with diabetes, there was a long period between that and being able to come to terms with thoughts around, yes, I do need to look at this packet, but I haven't got to worry about the fat or the calorie content. It was a long, long journey. I suppose if I go back to telling you a little bit about the psychiatric input in the inpatient ward, I was there for, 5 months, got to, I was still a very underweight person for a 6 foot young man, but they discharged me, and the eating disorder thoughts, or the cognitions that you get around eating, weight and shape, had not been addressed. So then I became obsessed with exercising. I was eating a bit better than before the first admission, but the eating very much was then dependent on how much exercise I could do. So what happened then was I was getting a lot of support from a day patient and still seeing a psychiatrist, but the weight continued to drop. I was then referred to a specialist eating disorder service, And in terms of the diabetes, because then I was dealing with a newly diagnosed, I was 18 at the time, newly diagnosed diabetes, trying to come to terms with that, getting a lot of hypos. Luckily, I never developed what they call diabulimia, which mm-hmm. is where you skip your insulin to lose weight. But I was having an obsession with the blood testing numbers, and was felt really bad if the numbers went high or the numbers went low. And obviously, if it went low, I was in then a lot of situations where I had to have emergency care, really, because parents had to phone the ambulance because they didn't know how to deal with the hypo properly. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of problems around my 18th birthday.
When you say hypo, right? Yeah. I'm just wondering if you could define that, because someone might be like, "Ooh, what is a hypo? What does that mean?"
Yeah, hypo is your hyperglycemic, so your blood sugar or your blood glucose levels is extremely low, and it means that you can't think in a way, you can't think coherently. You develop, some people describe it, it's a bit like when you're drunk, but to me it's not like that, it's a lot worse. You get very anxious, you get very sweaty, it's very dangerous, because if it goes that low it can kill you, you can go into a coma. Mm. And then the other way, hyper, yep. which is high blood glucose levels, is when you have a lot of other symptoms. Now, this is not quite as an emergency, but over long term, that's when then you might get diabetic complications such as neurological problems with your eyes or your feet, or be more likely to get other conditions such as problems with your heart or things like that over a long period of time if you have high blood sugar. Mm-hmm. So obviously when I was having low blood sugars, it led to a period of time where then you couldn't function, you know. So I could be at work, let's say, and I get a low blood sugar and I'm not recognising it, and you get something called hypo unawareness, so you don't realise it's going low.
Oh my gosh.
And because then there was a conflict between the eating disorder thought and the diabetes, how to look after yourself, sometimes I wouldn't eat. So you'd have thoughts like, okay, right, Steve, you need to take some Lucozade, you need to bring your blood sugar up. But then you'd have also the anorexia thinking, you can't have this. So that then led to quite a lot of serious problems whereby other people had to intervene. And on numerous occasions during, you know, my late teens and early 20s, it resulted in ambulances.
Wow. It sounds really traumatic to me. It sounds as in for your body and yourself to go through this disordering and the harm. It sounds very distressing. Did you experience
it's certainly very distressing to my parents. Mm-hmm. I suppose at the time it isn't distressing to you, but afterwards you get this massive sense of guilt of what you've put your friends or your family through to, you know, and again, that doesn't bode well for your self-esteem because you feel as though that's your fault, you should manage it better.
that's a whole episode. That's a whole other episode, right? It's the guilt and the shame of having experienced all of that.
So what happened next was that I'd come out of the hospital the first time round, and, you know, I was about 18. But like I said before, the eating disorder psychopathology, so the thoughts around food, weight and shape and control hadn't been addressed.
Mm-hmm.
So although I was eating better and slightly more, the exercise had gone up. And so the weight loss continued to go down and the hypos had increased. The more support from my parents was required. And obviously it wasn't doing me my self-esteem any good at all. I mean, in the end, I was referred to a specialist eating disorder service in Leicester, where I then stayed there as an inpatient for 11 months. Again, that was difficult because it was also away from my family. When they visited, they had to travel quite a distance. And although, I mean, I think that's what saved my life, being there. You know, because the first time round when I was in hospital, I didn't need a nasogastric tube. The second time in hospital, I didn't require that, but they knew how to sort of manage eating disorders and how to support people to eat better. And that's where I suppose I first got my first experience of being a client of psychotherapy.
Okay, and what was that like?
It was good. It felt as though somebody was listening to me. It felt as though somebody had an understanding of where I was coming from, that I was respected. You know, and that went on throughout my inpatient stay the second time round. And I also attended the day program, which was also something that was very helpful to normalise food and feel as though you were, you know, part of a respected group of people. And I think it was helpful because it was, you know, the staff there was great and they were very supportive. I suppose the only downside for me was I was the only male patient.
Oh, my.
Which again, didn't help with my own identity, really. You know, I was surrounded by a lot of other young women. You know, had similar problems and had similar thought processes, and you know, but at the same time, this compare and despair that a lot of people go through, sort of looking at somebody else and thinking you're not as good as them. Obviously, my comparison, an accurate comparison. And I say, well, no comparison is accurate, but. You know, I was comparing myself to women that were probably, you know, 5'5" and didn't need to eat as much as me to fuel your body healthily. So that was a challenge as well. But they were very supportive and I'm still friends with some of the people that I was in hospital with.
Wow.
So it's, you know, I stay in touch with them through social media.
And you know, when you were in the inpatient unit, Steve, did you feel like getting better? Did you feel motivated to change?
That's a hard question. I suppose early on, no. As time went on, yes. But I did develop a lot of feelings of guilt that was overwhelming, which did lead to self-harm, cutting and burning. And I think this hatred that I had of my body for it being, you know, having the disability, I think one part of me that's been really difficult to come to terms with over years and years, which I do feel as though I have done now, but accepting myself that partially I am disabled, but not at a level whereby people can recognise it immediately.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I suppose you never felt normal, inverted commas, and you never felt disabled. So it was one of those things whereby when I was in hospital, there was still a lot of guilt about my body and what I was doing to it, you know. So I wanted to be well, not having all the thoughts, but I didn't want to get any bigger because of the trauma that I had through being bullied about my body, and thought that would come back. So in terms of motivation, it was a strip drip approach, really, I suppose. Yeah. Also, when you're very underweight, Natalie, your brain doesn't, you know, process things correctly.
Right.
And the first thing we have to do is try to restore appropriate nutrition. You know, so I wasn't being able to think clearly about the food, you know, think clearly about my health, and help myself to recognize that I needed the food. It was just all still, this is about food.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the black and white thinking and the rigid rules and the, yeah, all of that.
Not being able to see the bigger picture was, is, you know, sort of a thing, you know, it was very much sort of very focused, very, you know, a point whereby, you know, it's either this or this, it can't be a shade of grey.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, Steve, again, you know, cerebral palsy, right? Would you mind defining that for us, your experience of that and how it continues to influence or influence your perception of your body for people who might need to go onto Google?
Yeah, of course. It's a condition that when you're born with it, and often when you're being born, what occurs is your brain gets starved of oxygen. So it then obviously affects the neurology of your brain. And for me, I was starved of oxygen after being born, during being born, and it affected my motor skills in, you know, and very, it's my fine motor skills that are more affected, you know, sort of having the ability, good dexterity, and being able to support myself to, you know, do tasks, daily tasks that other people might find easy. So, for example, walking for me is very difficult, not because I can't do it, but because I have to think about it, whereas a lot of people, it's natural.
Yeah.
So these are the things that, and again, I had several operations on my leg, my left leg, whilst the child, which again obviously made me think I'm different to other people.
Yeah.
And that was also emphasised by the bullying I experienced. So I think although no one thing is a cause of an eating disorder, or any mental health, no, you can't just say, oh, it's that one thing alone. It has had a big part on why I developed it, and how I tried to cope with it. Obviously, an eating disorder is just like any other mental health. It's a coping mechanism to try and deal with the difficulties you've got from your own body and from your own situation. And for me, the cerebral palsy, you know, it does affect me. It still affects me today. It feels, you know, but I have come to terms with it more. It's like I am more now able to say I won't be able to do that and ask for help. Whereas previously, for example, you know, throughout my childhood, you know, I think I was about 13 before I could tie a shoelace. You know, I mean, most children develop that at 5 or 6, you know, but I couldn't do that for a long time. So those kind of things were delayed, the motor skills.
Yeah.
And obviously it then made me feel more inferior.
Yeah.
Today, there's still things I know I can do. And obviously I've adapted through that my right side of body is you know, is inverted commas normal. So you adapt your way around of being able to navigate things in life mm-hmm. by adjusting how you do things. So for example, I can't, if I was wearing a long shirt, I can't fasten, you know, cuff buttons on my right hand. Mm-hmm. So obviously what I have to do is fasten it before I put it on and push my hand through. Mm. But yes, there has been occasions when that's broke the button, but it's the way that I cope to be able to help myself get dressed.
Yeah.
So there's these kind of things, and they're only small things, but at the same time, they do affect me. I also have some neurological pain in my left leg, which can be obviously not pleasant.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to come to terms with what you're born with. And I think you can change things, but there's some things you can't change.
Yeah.
And those things that you can't change, you've got to be able to figure out a way to navigate around it or to deal with it, to cope with it. And I think it's, no, when somebody's quite perfectionistic, like I was, and particularly, you know, people with anorexia do develop that trait and personality style. I think it's trying to help them to be more flexible, because some things you cannot change. There's a lot that you can change, but there's some things you can't change. And if you can't change it, then spending your time and effort on it to try and change it is, you know, just wasting your life.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I've realised that as I've, you know, come out of the mental health, having my own mental health problems, but it does take a long time to reflect and recognise and learn skills, ways, and other skills to navigate around it.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's so admirable that you... Yeah, like I'm just in awe that, you know, what you had to, I'm just listening to your story and I'm just imagining what you had to go through as a young boy, how you must have felt so different, and then being bullied and already feeling quite inferior, and then now coming to this place where there is a sense of radically accepting that, okay, this is who I am, and life can still be worth living and fun, and it doesn't make me bad or worse than other people.
It's just recognizing that we've all got strengths and weaknesses, isn't it? You know, I mean, if you've got, or what I prefer to say, strengths and needs rather than weaknesses. Mm. Needs are, so I suppose, where you need support from other people, and accepting that there are people around you that you can support you.
Mm.
But equally, you've also got a lot of strengths that you can support other people where they haven't got those strengths.
Yeah.
So, you know, no one's perfect. And unfortunately, the way that malnutrition can occur can start to make you feel as though that you've got to be perfect, you know, because it gets back into that black and white thinking, and it gets more intense the lower weight you are.
Mm-mm.
So if I tell you a little bit about sort of the experiences in hospital the second time round, like I say, very challenging. It pressed on a lot of my emotions. It made me more aware of my emotions. I had to have different ways of coping with it rather than not eating or over-exercising. Things I developed were, some of them were healthy, some of them weren't so. But, you know, you develop things like writing a diary of your thoughts and feelings. But I did become obsessed with that for a good 6 or 7 years until I realised that actually doing this just puts more stress on you. Also, organising clothes and having to have them in a perfect order in your wardrobe. Mm. Again, that was something that obviously is better. Having that obsession is a lot better than being excessively exercising or excessively restricting. But again, it was like a stepping stone to getting better.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as dangerous,
mm-hmm.
but it did make me realise as I got better and it was still limiting my life, particularly when I was at university, where I'm thinking I've got to sort all these clothes out in a particular order, very autistic side of way. But I was feeling as though I had to have that control over it.
Mm.
But then you start to realise, well, actually, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And you're missing out on so much if you have to do that.
Yeah.
But again, it's a learning process. And it's like I said before, I think, you know, sort of, it's like learning to drive. The therapy is like until you pass your test.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got to learn all again in the big world. And with the analogy of driving a car, you know, you only learn so much while you're doing your test and your, you know, driving test, and you're preparing it with your tutor. And then there's a lot of learning then when you're on your own. And that's what I did when I went to university.
Yeah. So what were your learnings from there on that helped you to feel more confident driving, you know, the car of life or the car of your soul?
I suppose it made me realize that thinking about food, weight and shape a lot of the time was not actually helping me. I realised that when it was isolating me at, you know, so for example, I was at university and friends would come and say, let's go out for a drink or let's go for a meal or whatever, and I wouldn't do it because I had the eating disorder thoughts still saying,
yeah,
no, you can't do that today. But my awareness was that at the time when you thoughts were the gospel,
right,
I start to realize that actually we have a lot of thoughts that we don't necessarily follow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I always give the analogy, you know, I thought, oh, I need the toilet, but you delay it because the phone rings. that's a thought that you've gone against. And I suppose it's helping people to realize that you don't have to follow your thoughts. The thoughts are not set in stone. And I suppose what I started to realise, particularly during my university experiences, was that actually you could go against what you think.
Mm.
And there isn't then a massive negative consequence.
That's huge.
I mean, not only was obviously at university I was doing psychology, so it was also something that was helping me to understand the mind and behaviour again,
mm.
You know, but also being able to relate it to my own experiences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I found that I was accepted more at university for who I was rather than for what I looked like.
That's huge. That's a huge one in recovery. It's the re-establishment that I can be accepted, that I am safe, right? That interpersonal relationships can be meaningful and fulfilling and safe.
I mean, I would question, yeah, I totally agree. I would question sort of how, you know, recovery. I don't know where recovery actually is. It's not a set point.
But yeah.
I would say that I consider myself to have been recovered since about 26. But that don't mean to say that I didn't then have any more thoughts about food, weight or shape. It's just, I think I was in more control of my life than the eating disorder was.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, I mean, there was a lot of times during university whereby, you know, I then started vomiting, self-induced vomiting, mm-hmm. to compensate.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's a very dangerous coping strategy to use. But it's important people to realise that whichever behaviour you're doing, it's another coping strategy for dealing with the emotions.
Yeah.
That I think over my lifetime, I've gone to less and less maladaptive coping strategies to deal with emotions.
Mm.
Like I say, it took me a good 6 years to stop.
Yeah.
Feeling as though I had to write my journal.
Yeah.
Now, on one hand, writing a journal is a good thing, but when it's then getting in the way of you going to work or being able to do things socially with friends, it's then a problem.
Yeah. I think that's it, isn't it? It's that when it starts isolating you and you start and there's no flexibility, then you're like, okay, like, something is going on here. And I totally agree with what you're saying. And that is that, you know, beneath the behavior, right, whether that's restricting, purging, exercising, taking laxatives, it's that it's someone's best attempt at regulating what feels intolerable and these big feelings, these big emotions. So how do you cope, let's say, with anxiety now, right? When you do get that anxious feeling, what's your... Yeah.
I mean, I'm happy to say that I still have this anti-anxiety medication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, been on citalopram for a good 10, 15 years, and before that, other tablets, and I still take it, and it is reviewed by my GP, but I do find it's helpful, because I do think that sometimes we're in a stressful job as clinical psychologists, and you do need to be able to deal with your anxiety. So obviously I've got a lot of behavioural strategies and a lot of strategies to be able to help me, you know, process information and come to realise and be more rational about it. So at work, I use obviously my supervision. I use being able to sort of have time to reflect on things rather than just jump to them.
Yeah.
Being positive. And outside work, obviously, it's talking with friends. It's using things like breathing exercises, mindfulness. So being able to just take a moment and recognise the present moment rather than letting your thoughts run away with the past or the what's going to happen.
Mm.
I think I still struggle. I'm a lot better than I was about past stuff, sort of feeling bad about what's happened. I still do get that anxiety dread and the recognition of... you know, sort of your physical changes, the fight, flight, freeze response with what might happen in the future.
Of course.
But again, the ways I manage it is, like, say, sometimes just taking a few minutes out, doing some breathing, thinking of things that are not related to the subject that you're getting a bit stressed about,
mm-hmm.
being able to just have a sounding board, whether that's just... you know, not that somebody's going to change it, but just getting somebody to listen to what your concerns are can be very helpful to me.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I do still do some exercise, but it's limited at home rather than at, you know, going to the gym and being obsessed with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I have an exercise bike and I'll do that 3 times a week. Sometimes I've been now that flexible whereby obviously if something else comes in, I can miss it. So
yeah.
I was, you know, it's something that I will do. But if I know I'm getting stressed, for example, I'll recognise that actually, Steve, you are going on the exercise bike too much. So there's clear markers for me to know when I'm getting more stressed. Another one, obviously, is that you're thinking in bed too much and not falling into sleep. So you get to learn your own body in your own way, that you know when you're being faced with more stress and understand what distraction, what coping strategies, what people you can talk to for you to help you to get through those stresses of life. Because at the end of the day, Natalie, everything in life, there's going to be good times and there's going to be bad times. And people need to be able to understand when that's touching their buttons and, you know, getting them emotional, and how to deal with that in more adaptive ways rather than using things that are maladaptive.
Yeah, yeah. I couldn't agree more. It's all about balance and that self-awareness piece, right? Of knowing when, like you said, if you're going too much on the exercise bike and taking it back and using your other tools. Yeah. And, you know, with your journey and your story, right, I think there's just so, so much more to it that we probably don't have the time to dive deeply into. But there's something you said earlier, Steve, which I really think we need to maybe talk about a little bit more, which is this concept of recovery, right? It's like you're recovering or you're recovered. Again, it's like that black and white category when, in fact, really, like you said, you can be clinically recovered, but still be experiencing these lingering thoughts and feelings. It doesn't mean that you are not well. It just means that you're discovering and learning more about yourself.
Definitely. I mean, like I say, eating disorder psychopathology, so the thoughts, feelings, and behaviors of an eating disorder do pop up from time to time. Mm-hmm. You know, I can have a negative automatic thought, oh, Steve, you're fat or you look awful, you know. But at the same time, most people experience those things.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's known where the crossover is of, well, actually, when are you on mental health territory? And when are you well? You know, because it's the same with, like, people that hear voices. Do you know what I mean? Some people hear voices
mm-hmm.
and they're absolutely fine, mentally well. You know, and then other people are, you know, in hospital because they've got, you know, sort of the point where it's affected their functioning.
That's right.
So it is, you know, sort of, you know, it's a point where actually there is a scale, isn't there? There's a way, you know, there's a point where you need to know this is affecting your life rather than, you know, it is there and it may be something that is a inconvenience or an annoyance,
mm-hmm.
but it's known when it crosses over to a point where it's actually affecting your own well-being.
Yeah.
And I think everybody is different. So, you know, nobody can say you're fully recovered except the person.
Mm.
Now, they can say you're clinically recovered and they can say, you know, hospitals and practitioners can say, yes, you're fully, you know, restored in your way, you're not mm-hmm. as impulsive, or you're not, whatever it is, they can say at a clinical level, you have no longer got this condition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But actually, it's only the individual
that's right
that can say, I'm fully recovered.
Yeah, yeah, and if I, whether I feel free in my body and in my relationship with food and eating and in my life. So it's a big word and very subjective as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think sometimes people don't, particularly with eating disorders, sometimes people don't want to let it go because there's the worry that if they let it go, you know, they're not, they haven't got that coping strategy anymore.
Or like, who am I as well, right? Like, who am I without it, especially if it's going on for a long time?
Because obviously having an identity is important to anyone's life. And, you know, sometimes it's valued to have an identity that you've got an eating disorder. So, you know, I think being able to feel confident and comfortable enough to drop it and say, right, well, yes, I'm this person, I'm X, Y, or Z without an eating disorder, the person's got to have built up their self-esteem and feel comfortable with that.
And how did you do that? How Yeah, what was that like for you to say, nope, this is no longer going to define me. I don't need this to define me. I'm ready to let it go.
I suppose, and again, that's a very difficult question to say when or how. I suppose over time, what's happened is I've replaced the experiences that I have with an eating disorder into being able to use it as part of my profession and, you know, be able to get the rewards and the boost to my own self-esteem through other means, through my job, through my hobbies, through my interactions with my friends. So that, when we're looking at somebody with an eating disorder, it's important to understand what maintains it. And for me, I felt what maintained it was something that I felt I was good at. You know, and I felt as though it was something that helped me to be recognised and identified. And now I've got a professional identity, but also an identity as a friend and as somebody that, you know, can support other people both professionally and personally. That helps me to, you know, say, well, I don't need the label of an eating disorder now.
Yeah, you're so much more than the way you look or like the way you could look or what you eat or what you're not eating. Yeah.
And like I say, like I said to you before, I still struggle with the diabetes and coming to terms with that. Yeah. Even after 22 years of having it, but it's something that still causes me anxiety and... But anxiety is part of life. So, you know, I now look at anxiety as not something that's absolutely dreadful. It's something that's usually short term and something that you can manage or deal with and get over the hurdle with it. Yeah. It's not something that is going to define my life.
Yeah.
But you've got to accept that part of living involves the range of emotions.
Yes.
I think, with my diabetes, it's probably going to cause me some anxiety for the rest of my life.
Of course.
And it's just something you have to navigate and manage.
Mm.
So, unless they can find a cure for type 1 diabetes, I mean, I now have these sensors that have made my life a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
So... You know, just you go on and it tells you what your blood sugar is. So at the moment it's 6.6, which is in the normal range. But that helps me. That certainly helps me with my anxiety around it. I've only had that for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And that's helped me both personally and professionally.
Yeah, I love that. You know, ultimately, I think at the end of the day, it's about embracing, right, our humanness, and that it's unrealistic to expect ourselves to only to feel good all the time. That anxiety is so human. Like, it doesn't mean that something is wrong with you. Yeah.
I mean, I suppose the last thing I just wanted to say was about, obviously, my support in my professional career for people with eating disorders and their carers and their parents. So I spent my career sort of trying to help parents and carers of people with eating disorders, because for me, they are the pinnacle of helping people to get better, as well as, you know, and when I say carer, it doesn't have to be a parent. Be and be a friend, a family member, a colleague or whatever, but helping them to understand eating disorders, but also helping them to manage their own stress.
Mm.
Because when you're caring for somebody with an eating disorder, it's very, very stressful and very, you know, you feel out of depth. And again, obviously I haven't had that personally, but I do know that personally through my parents, through my friends. So that's what I did my doctorate on, and I've then done a lot of support with working with BEAT, the National Eating Disorders Charity, which I don't no longer do that now because I focus more on the local charity, but it's something that I feel as though is required more to support parents and carers, because I look at eating disorders as a systemic disorder rather than it's just in an individual.
Absolutely.
If you can get the people around the person to understand and to do the things that help, the young person is then going to be in a much better position to move towards recovery.
Yes, yes. I will definitely have to invite you back again to, because I think family work and the systemic work requires, it requires another podcast episode, doesn't it? Because there's just so much there.
Yeah, definitely. And I'd be happy to do that. You know, like you say, sounds like, I mean, I could talk for an hour on diabetes. I could talk for an hour on, but I suppose, you know, we've only got so long and
it's been really good. Sorry, you were saying?
I'm just saying it's been really good for us to talk about this, because I do feel as though people shouldn't be ashamed. There's always been this us and them sort of view about how clinicians or professionals shouldn't have mental health problems.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think we are breaking it down now, like, integrate mental health, for example, is trying to break those barriers down. But it's still out there as though, okay, people come and see a professional, they must be sorted.
They must have it all together. Yeah.
Yeah. And it isn't like that. Do you know what I mean? Yes, okay, we may have gone through stuff and we may be managing things better, but we also don't know what's around the corner in life, and something could hit somebody. And a professional is equally as, you know, susceptible of getting a mental health problem as is, you know, a patient.
Yeah.
So, and I think we need to acknowledge that as, you know, as a society, really, to be able to understand that actually we're all humans, and we're all susceptible to the same mental health conditions.
Yeah, we're all vulnerable. Yeah. Well, Steve, thank you so much for all of your insight, your knowledge, and your generosity, you know, in terms of sharing everything that you have learned. And I'm sure there's so much more that you have to share. But before we, you know, bring this episode to an end, I was wondering if you could share maybe one thing that you would like to tell your younger self. I know that's a big question, so maybe just one thing. If you looked back in your life, what?
I'd like to tell myself that, yes, there's going to be difficulties ahead, but you can cope with them. And you've got to allow other people to help you. I think, for me personally, I felt as though I couldn't ask for help. I felt as though I should be able to do it. That should word, that must word. You know, if you ask for help, then there's something wrong with you. That's sort of the view I had as a youngster. Yeah. If I can go back now and tell that young person, tell me, and say, look, it's okay to ask for help. It's okay that you have needs. It's okay that you need help in things. Then maybe, if I'd have listened to myself, I may have not then as it had not led to an eating disorder like it did. But if you also said to me now, Natalie, that do I ever wish I never had an eating disorder, I'd have said no, because I'm glad that I have, because it's made me who I am today, and it's helped me to forge a career and also help me to reflect on myself and understand myself better. So there's, you know, obviously nobody ever wants to wish themselves having an eating disorder or any mental health problem, but I think a lot of people that have gone through mental health problems, most of them would probably say, I've learned a lot through it.
Yeah. I resonate with that fully. Yeah, because I have my own lived experience of anorexia too, so I completely resonate with you here. So, yeah, that's really powerful message, right? It's that you can ask for help. Don't be afraid to seek for support. And yeah, it's a strange thing, isn't it? That it seems like the most logical and most reasonable thing to do, to seek for support when you're suffering, but sometimes it can be the hardest thing to do.
Yeah, and I think young people sometimes feel that, you know, it makes them more isolated because they feel as though they can't do that. And I think talking like we are doing today about mental health and getting it out there that actually it is okay to talk about.
Yes.
You know, it's hopefully that will reduce how many people feel like I did when I was young.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. Well, thank you so much, Steve. And I'm sure we will reconnect again at some point and have you back on.
Thank you very much, Natalie.
All right, bye now.
Bye.
Hey everyone, it's Natalie here. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to leave me a review at Apple Podcasts. All right, you guys, thanks so much for listening once again, and I'll see you in the next one.